You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Thursday morning. It's perhaps a little early to record in Trump world. There might be 10,000 crazy things that happen in the next 36 hours.
Yeah.
There was a fairly big scoop earlier in the week that Mueller's team told Trump's team, Trump's legal team, that Trump is not currently a criminal target, although he is being investigated, which has sparked discussion whether apparently Trump, if we take the reporting to be accurate, and who the heck really knows, but it's always a little surprising to me that Trump acts the way in private as he does in public, that he actually hears, oh, I'm not a target. You see, it's all going to be good, guys. We're all in the clear. If he's willing to say that at a rally. But you might think privately, when your lawyers say, you know what, guy, don't assume just because you're not a target today doesn't mean you can't be a target tomorrow. But he has this sort of built-in cerebral wiring to, filter out all the bad stuff.
Well, remember, this is what James Comey told him originally.
Right, right.
That he's not a target. And this started it all, really. It started a lot of it where Trump wanted to insist that Comey come forward and say that you're not, the target of this investigation or whatever.
So that discussion comes along at the same time that there's a sort of parallel discussion whether Mueller is even able to indict Trump. Is it constitutional to indict
right.
a sitting president? And does he have the
A lot of people think that it is not
right,
possible.
Right. And there's also a question whether does the special counsel under Justice Department rules and regulations is able to indict the president. So
the president just pardon himself?
I mean, there's that question as well. So there's a lot of conventional wisdom out there that if Mueller was to do anything, he would, drop a bunch of information on Congress and basically say, it's up to you what to do here. He probably wouldn't say, I ask you to impeach. You just say, here's a bunch of stuff. If you want to impeach, go ahead and impeach. If you don't, you don't. It's your call. There's not a lot of people assuming that Mueller's going to stick his neck out on an actual indictment. But I have a piece over at Politico which makes the argument that if, and obviously this is an if, Mueller believes Trump committed a crime and should be held accountable, that you can't expect Congress to finish that job for you. That is a tainted jury pool. Mueller's has been smeared and demonized by the Sean Hannity crew. More than half of Republicans disapprove of Mueller's handling the investigation. There's very little expectation. I mean, there's almost no expectation that House Republicans would vote to impeach. But it could happen if Democrats take over the House. But if they took over the House, even if they took over the Senate, even if they won literally every Senate seat on the table in 2018, which of course wouldn't happen, you would have 58 Democrats. You need 2/3 to convict. You need to get 67 senators. So at the barest minimum, you need 9 Republicans who are willing to say, I'm going to convict Donald Trump and oust him from office, when these guys can barely challenge Trump on tariffs. So if you're Mueller, you got to say to yourself, if Trump's going to be held accountable, my only choice is indictment. If I don't do that, there's no chance. And then that gets into, so this is why if you're a Democrat or someone else who wants to see Trump held accountable, don't waste your breath on impeachment. And if a candidate on the trail is telling you, vote for me, I'll vote to impeach, that person's snowing you. If you're Tom Steyer, who has the Need to Impeach movement, This is a list building exercise, people. You are not getting impeachment by signing Tom Steyer's petition. That is a dead letter. But as you mentioned, Matt, there is this question. Can Mueller even do that? So if you go to my piece, I mean, I'm happy to talk about more with you, but I lay out what various legal scholars have been saying about Mueller's authority, and there's a great deal of debate around that. If you're a Democrat, you want to be airing out that debate and hopefully giving Mueller political space to say, you know what, I know I'm setting legal precedent here, but I can do this and have the public's backing.
So, I mean, you're not an attorney, I don't think.
I am not.
But so you've looked at, obviously, this has been a topic that's been debated a lot. You were sort of aggregating some of the best scholars and what they've written or said about this and sort of laying out that case.
Right. So the initial argument's been laid out by the Justice Department itself. They have an Office of Legal Counsel, whose job it is to give legal advice to the president and to executive branches, including the Justice Department itself. They had a memo in the Nixon years saying you can't indict a sitting president. It makes it becomes impossible for the president to perform his constitutional duties. Therefore, there's no way to interpret the Constitution as saying you can shackle the president in that way. That opinion was further was reiterated and elaborated on in 2000 during the Clinton presidency. Again, arguing that you have the impeachment avenue available if the president is to be ousted, but you can't have the president being tied up in this way because the president can't do his or her job. Now, the special and independent counsels at those two points in time did not agree with the Justice Department's OLC. They had separate memos. One was by several people on the Watergate special counsel staff. In 1988, there was a scholar named Richard Rotunda who gave a memo to Ken Starr arguing there's nothing in the Constitution that says the president is above the law. If in 74, they said, look, if it turns out that the president can't do his duties, you know, Congress can impeach them if they want to, but don't assume that the president can't, you know, and if it's the case, there's a mechanism for that. And Rotunda in 98 said even further, there's also a 25th Amendment. You can have a temporary replacement of the president with the vice president if it so happens that president can't perform his duties.
Okay, but Bill, you know the old expression, you can indict a ham sandwich.
A grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. And that's how this would work, by the way. It's not Mueller by himself. Mueller would ask a grand jury to indict. And there's a separate question whether Rosenstein would let him do that, but go on.
But isn't there a slippery slope of you could have frivolous indictments of a president that really would? So maybe you could make an argument that we have exceptional instances right now that maybe we will have evidence that Donald Trump did something so egregious that this should happen. But wouldn't this open the door for more litigation against a sitting president that really would cripple the presidency?
Well, this, you know, a criminal indictment is not the same as a civil lawsuit. And we already had the civil lawsuit discussion with Clinton, Paula Jones. And the Supreme Court said you can file a civil lawsuit against a sitting president. That is now precedent already. You're not going to have a frivolous criminal indictment because that's only going to happen by the Justice Department, which the president appoints the attorney general of. The error there is that that game is rigged and the president will never be indicted for crimes. It's amazing that things get this far.
Okay, so then let me ask you the other. It sounds like you're laying a case that says that in this instance, the well has been poisoned. We can't expect the balance of powers, the checks and balances to work as they should. Therefore, we have to take this extreme measure. would you agree that in a perfect world, the impeachment option should be the mechanism that's used and the disincentive against presidents abusing power?
Well, I don't look at it as the system is broken if you can't impeach. Impeachment is a political process. It is not a legal process. A president will get impeached if Congress wants to impeach the president, and Congress will want to impeach the president if they think the public wants the Congress to impeach and convict. If it so happens that Congress, there's not a two-thirds sentiment in the country to impeach and oust the president, then it's not going to happen. That's not the system not working. That's the system working. But
you can impeach him.
But you can impeach the majority vote in the House, but you right. need the supermajority to convict. And if that supermajority sentiment in the public isn't there, you're probably not going to get that in the Senate. That's the system working as intended. A legal matter is different than a political matter. Legality is not contingent upon public sentiment.
Okay, but my question, though, is, did the founders, was their intent that the mechanism for policing and punishing a president was to be done via this mechanism of impeachment?
Well, and this gets to the constitutional debate. You can say they create impeachment so there would be a mechanism for doing that and not have them be subject to criminal indictment. And the counter argument is, well, they didn't not say they didn't say you can't indict. And endemic in the whole enterprise is that nobody's above the law. So why would you assume there's some special exemption here? So there is a separate question whether Mueller can make this judgment himself, because you have this existing Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel memo, which says it is our guidance that you cannot do that. Is Mueller bound by that? So the argument, and so this is brought forth by Rotunda again. Richard Rotunda had a separate article in the Washington Post recently. Walter Dellinger, who was the head of the OLC under Clinton, not in 2000, but before then, he had a piece in the New York Times saying, yes, you can indict a sitting president, although his wrinkle was that since the 2000 OLC memo is very persuasive, you should be able to indict today and have the trial tomorrow. Don't make the president go through the trial while they're president. But since there's a 5-year statute of limitations on most federal crimes, you should be allowed to make the indictment in the moment and wait till later. So Rotunda says the OLC, their mission is to give controlling advice to executive branches. Therefore, Mueller should be controlled by that. And Dellinger says, he doesn't quite go that far, but he says that Mueller should essentially cross his T's and go back to the OLC and say, no, you touched upon this issue in your 2000 memo, but can you explore more deeply the question whether I can indict now and have the trial later and see if you can get that?
I kind of like that. I kind of like that idea, because I think it's a compromise that really addresses number one, the concern that nobody's above the law, even the president, but also would prevent the president from being bogged down while he's president.
Although having the indictment cloud over your head is probably still a bit of a problem.
Well, in this era, though, I don't think it would matter that much anymore. Maybe at one point it would have been debilitating.
Right. I mean,
and it would have been.
You're dealing with a president who's barely doing any work as it is. he would just take the indictment and say, the deep state's out to get me.
Yeah.
Stick with me. We'll fight these bastards.
Well, and then the great thing is he couldn't pardon himself either, by definition, because he wouldn't be president anymore when the trial happened.
Right.
Let me ask you this, Bill, just as a process question. There are certain things that I'm pitched to write about, and I can write them immediately because I've basically been building up the capital to write about them for years. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, in other words, there are things that are in my wheelhouse, and if something happens, I could write about it. If someone said to me, if an assignment editor said, Matt, I want you to write about whether or not the president can indict or can be indicted, I would, number one, email you and ask you what I should do. then I would start reading. Yeah, I would have to go to school. Like, I couldn't do it quickly. I would have to go to school a little bit. I have to probably talk to some people and read, you know, I would have to really do my homework. Is this the kind of thing that you were up to speed on already?
No. I was Googling like a madman about this stuff. I basically caught the Dellinger op-ed, which, you know, cited the Office of Legal Counsel memos. I had some recollection that there was a New York Times piece last year about a counter memo in the Ken Starr days. So I dug that up, and, you know, just it leads to a chain of events. You're sort of following the breadcrumbs of the ongoing argument. And there's been some robust discussion about this on the Lawfare blog, run by a fellow Oberlin graduate, Benjamin Wittes, who was known, you know, that blog became kind of splashy when he was talking about Comey a lot. He's apparently knows Comey somewhat well. But there was another piece on that site by a Harvard law prof named Andrew Crespo, who says the Office of Legal Counsel is not determinative of what Mueller can or can't do, because under the law, it says the special counsel has independent authority to investigate and prosecute crimes. And there's even an Office of Legal Counsel document from way back when that says that their opinions don't apply for those who are authorized by law to make their own judgments. So it's not a clean cut case what Mueller can or can't do. And on top of that, I should add, Kressel points out that while Rosenstein supervises Mueller, so generally speaking, if Mueller is going to indict, he's got to go to Rosenstein and say, "Hey, I'm going to do this. Do I have your okay? I'm going to ask the grand jury for the indictment. Do you have your okay to do that?" According to Crespo, Rosenstein can't deny Mueller without reason. He has to argue that what Mueller wants to do violates Justice Department regulations, and he's got to inform Congress why he did that. So, all things being equal, you know, Mueller, my sense is a pretty by the book guy. This has never been done before. You know, breaking with the OLC, indicting a president at all, it's never been tried. So it's never been adjudicated at the Supreme Court level. We don't know what the precedent is, what they would say. Mueller's inclination might be, you know what, let's just do this the way it's been done before. Here, Congress, here's what I learned. And my argument to him is, if you really believe Trump's needs to be held accountable, that might be the nice way to go about it. That might be path of least resistance. Obviously, if you try to indict Trump, they're going to fight you like hell. You're going to get, you know, tons of crap from, you know, Trump's loyalists. You're going to have to fight this in the Supreme Court. It's going to be totally dragged out. It's going to absorb the rest of your remaining days on this earth. But there's really no other way to do it, because impeachment is just not a feasible option for you.
Don't you think? I think it probably would really matter what they find. Like, if they find that he, you know, had some sort of a business, legal, cheated on his taxes kind of thing before he was president, that would be different than if they found, you know, evidence that he was directly colluding with the Russians to win the election.
Well, remember the Karl Rove investigation when Patrick Fitzgerald was the special counsel, and they seem to have gotten fairly close to indicting Rove, and Rove's lawyers actually begged them not to, arguing that there was some reasonable doubt whether, you know, Rove was intending to leak and whatnot. And Fitzgerald concluded, you know what, this is not quite strong enough a case. I mean, you could have argued that that the prosecutor shouldn't have to be so squeamish about it, but prosecutors all the time exercise prosecutorial judgment. You know, is this really open and shut? Do I have a strong case here? Is it worth all the efforts going to be put into this, or is there an alternative decision that I can make? So it may be that Mueller says, you know what, some ticky-tack business from 20 years ago, I'm not going to go break in China to pursue that. Money laundering to cover up colluding with a foreign power, he might say, I really can't look away from that. And I have one one of my faithful readers on Twitter was arguing to me that Mueller shouldn't do it on obstruction of justice alone, because that will look like a political thing. There's an argument that, you know, the Alan Dershowitz argument, Trump can't commit obstruction of justice. To say that's a crime, you're criminalizing a political act, say within the sphere of president's constitutional authority. Maybe Mueller wouldn't want to stick his neck out on that. Of course, on the left, you'd say obstruction of justice is enormous. How could you look away from obstruction of justice? That's a big deal. I don't know what Mueller's thinking is on that subject, but he may well have to weigh those kinds of considerations.
All right. Well, I thought that was very informative.
I'm here to teach, Matt.
That's great, Matt.
Now, you had a piece in the Daily Beast, which is on a very interesting subject, about Trump's fight with Amazon. And obviously, it's unseemly for the president to be trying to single out a business which he doesn't like because they one of its appendages says mean things about him. Or it's actually the Washington Post. I mean, they're both owned by Jeff Bezos, Amazon and Washington Post. But you're making the point that, you know, Trump's not, you know, flailing wildly here. There are legitimate issues about Amazon's breath and monopolistic tendencies that should be discussed here.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I don't know if Trump is, I mean, I assume he has, you know, the ulterior motives that you've suggested about Jeff Bezos, right? But he's also instinctively a very good politician in a sense of tapping into fears and anxieties amongst the sort of populist base. A test of the Arlington County Wireless Emergency Alert System. No action. I get these when we tape in.
They're looking out for you.
It's almost as if Jeff Bezos knows what we're doing. Almost as if this thing's listening and knows. Trump has a good sense of that. And so I think whether intentional or not, and we put the stuff about the post office giving him a sweetheart deal, which I think has some validity. It's legal, but they're kind of exploiting a situation, which, hey, that's what businesses do, right? The stuff about them not paying taxes is no longer true, because now they collect taxes in the 95 states that have state sales taxes or whatever that is. But I think there is a larger truth to the fact that Amazon is an innovation that has caused disruption. And I think on the left, you've had, you know, this is more of a consistent thing, right? So like people like Bernie Sanders were probably mad at Walmart and now they're mad at Amazon, and it's a sort of a consistent thing. It's a big versus little. It's a big, the big guy versus the little guy thing. Another test of the District of Columbia's wireless. Bezos. Not working. You talking about this.
Can't shut Matt Lewis down.
I feel like Bezos and Jobs, they're all connected, even though he's dead somehow. And I think Zuckerberg's in on this as well. So now you know how I feel on cable news when I get interrupted or make a point. So the left has been probably a little more consistent on this, but I think everybody else, we were all tech utopians before. And I think, you know, conservatives by and large, we've thought that creative destruction is ultimately a good thing. You know, sure, some people are hurt. The horse and buggy makers, they lose their job, but the automobile ushers in, you know, convenience and more jobs and more opportunities. And that's sort of always happened, you know. That's been innovation, more ideas, technology. You know, there's ups and downs, but by and large, we've prospered. Most of us have prospered from these innovations. Now I think there's a real fear, and there's a sense that like maybe that's not always going to be the case because of automation. Now, Trump has actually directed more of his ire at immigration and outsourcing or globalization, and but innovation and automation are actually probably more likely to hit those of us. Hang on. Fairfax County. I'm going to put this down. Maybe I'll just turn the phone off. Anyway, you know where I'm going with this, yeah. Bill Scherer.
Well, the Matt Lewis I know was really enamored with Uber and was incredulous that liberals would have the temerity to want to regulate this wonderful service that was making taking cab rides so much more pleasant. And this was just shows that whenever innovation did crop up, there was the nanny state left trying to stick its nose in their business and take away a nice handy app on our phone that we all love and enjoy. So why is it now that there are conservatives, Trump and otherwise, who are suddenly getting squeamish about the reach of Amazon, the reach of Facebook? Isn't this just the market share? Amazon has market share because people like using Amazon. It is a convenient service to use to buy goods. People go to Facebook because they had a nice platform for sharing photos of their kids and arguing about politics. What is it about those entities that is pushing conservative buttons in a way that, that Uber and Airbnb did not?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm still a fan of Uber. I take Uber all the time, and I use Amazon all the time. And I've gone to bookstores and looked at books and then gone home and ordered it on Amazon.
Oh, you're a horrible person, Matt Lewis.
That's horrible, right? How bad is that?
That's the worst.
That's putting mom and pop out of business, or even Barnes & Noble or Borders out of business. I mean, I used to love going to those Borders or Barnes. There used to be one in downtown D.C. on like 19th and L, a big Barnes & Noble or Borders. I forget. It doesn't even matter which one. I would go in there. I would read their books. I would drink. Maybe I might drink a cup of coffee there. And I would go order it on Amazon. It was horrendous. I'm part of the problem, Bill. I am part of the problem. I do love the little, the sort of cool, hip, little, like, used bookstores. And I think I might start visiting them more. So obviously some of this is, like, self-serving and hypocritical, and it's just, Donald Trump's president? Let's get on the Trump bandwagon. I think some of it is the product of people like me who said, well, this used to be a left versus right paradigm, and now it's not, right? So Trump won. That means that there are a lot of people ostensibly on my side who, right or wrong, are worried about modernity and are worried about technology. And so I need to start, like, at least understanding their concerns. Mm-hmm. I can't just dismiss it as, oh, they're a bunch of leftists. Mm-hmm. And they're on the other, you know, they're like, this is a phenomenon I can't ignore and I can't dismiss as being, well, they disagree fundamentally with me because they're so I need to pay attention to it. Doesn't mean I need to agree with them, but be aware and understanding of where they're coming from. And then the last point I would make is I do think the situation on the ground has changed, right? Let's take Uber. What happens when the self-driving cars replace the Uber driver, right? So now it's not just a better business that's more efficient and more responsive to my needs as a consumer. It's also a business that replaces tons of employees, right? And instead of that Uber driver now being a free agent who can be out there hustling, making money on his own, driving, working for himself, now he's done. So I think there is a fear that this version of creative destruction will result in mass unemployment. And with unemployment, it's not just an economic problem, although it is an economic problem. It is also a spiritual problem. It is a psychological problem. It is a problem with meaning and purpose. It's a very deep subject. That's it in a nutshell.
How much of this is not about the specific issues at play, but is about cultural association. You don't see conservatives complain about government subsidies for oil and coal, because oil and coal are seen as like conservative goods. You know, liberals hate coal and oil because they're bad for the environment, so I'm going to like them. Whereas Amazon and Facebook, these Silicon Valley billionaires and their secular liberal values, and now Amazon's buying a media company, the Washington Post, even worse. So they're on my team, so I'm going to go give them.
But I think a better analogy would be the Walmart one. Mm-hmm. Because Walmart, I think you're right about oil and all that, but there's too many differences. I think Walmart is culturally conservative and Amazon is culturally liberal. Mm-hmm. And there are differences. Walmart does employ people in your local community. Now they both destroy local ma and pa stores, right? Mm-hmm. And they both, destroy Main Street and brick and mortar places. And I think that's why the sort of the populist left, the Bernie Sanders left, has been consistently against them, because I think he sees it, or they see it, as a kind of a big versus small paradigm. But in terms of a lot of the left, or a lot of liberals and a lot of conservatives, I think it does come down to, like, where do you align? You know, it is perceived that Silicon Valley and Seattle and all that are liberal, and it is perceived that Walmart is like red state. And so, yeah. Now Trump, part of the interesting appeal about Trump is that he is in some ways mixing that left versus he's reordering things mm-hmm. in a Bernie Sanders sort of way. So that's interesting.
So another issue where I think this is happening is trade. And it's not published yet, but by the time this goes up, I think it will be published at Real Clear Politics. So Trump.
Well, you're back. Bill Scherr's back.
Back at Real Clear Politics. RCP. That's right. Small hiatus, but all is good again.
I made a couple. I let Tom and Carl know that nice website you got there. It'd be a shame if something were to happen. What if Drudge were no longer linking to that website? Just kidding. I have zero pull. But congrats.
Thank you. So Trump is now really following through on his. On his campaign promises, he laid down the tariffs on China. China's responding in kind, although I think both of these things are still technically proposals. They haven't actually been put into effect yet. So there's still some chance they'll have some kind of negotiation and stand down. But clearly the markets are rattled. It's already affecting the agricultural sector. But those Democrats who have been pushing for aggressive trade policy vis-a-vis China are generally supporting Trump. Chuck Schumer, who has long been a trade critic, I mean, maybe not the most virulent one, but he voted against NAFTA. He was against TPP.
I'm done with TPP.
He's always pushed for labeling China a currency manipulator. He said, "I want to give Trump a pat on the back," and then he complained that neither Bush or Obama did what he wanted to see Trump do. Sherrod Brown, who's running for re-election in Ohio, he said, "I wanted to see Trump be aggressive, and Trump's being aggressive." Bob Casey in Pennsylvania said he was happy to see Trump doing this. Now, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who will likely run for president, their rhetoric is a bit different. Warren said that, I want to get my quote right here. I'll tell you Bernie, off the top of my head.
Bill, there's no room for getting your facts right in a show like this. Damn it. I've told you numerous times no fact checking, and for crying out loud, wing it.
So Warren said the other day, when President Trump says he's putting tariffs on the table, I think tariffs are one part of reworking our trade policy overall. So it's not quite, I love every little thing that he did, but she's sort of directionally approving of his approach. And Bernie was a bit more skeptical on that. He said, Trump is identifying a problem. Certainly China's role in dumping an enormous amount of steel has to be dealt with. In my view, though, what you need is a more comprehensive approach than Trump is laying out. So it's a little bit of distance there, but there's still
Bernie was also complimentary on the Amazon.com stuff.
Yes, on CNN.
But he also had the caveat, like, I don't think you should be I can't do the impersonation.
Right, right.
My impersonation would be Larry David, but anyway.
But he
said, like, I don't... Go ahead.
Well, I was saying, he's being generally supportive of the direction Trump's going in and complaining about the style.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if things go haywire, he has the plausible deniability to say, well, I wouldn't have done it just like that. Warren could potentially say that too. But think if it's, 2019, early 2020 or even the general election, and let's just, as hypothetical, conclude that Trump's policy didn't work out well. Prices went up. Certain sectors got knocked on their heels. Markets got rattled. And people are really unhappy with how Trump handled trade. Is a message saying, well, I would do a similar thing, but do it a little bit differently. I don't think it's going to be a very palatable message in that scenario. So Democrats need to make a tough call because you don't know exactly how it's going to play out. You don't know exactly what Trump's going to do, how far he's going to go, if he's going to keep pushing with China or stand down. Is he going to pull out an NAFTA or stay in? You don't know that. But I do think we can say for sure, whatever Trump does, it's not bringing manufacturing jobs back in any kind of significant number, because that ship has sailed. The way Trump does things in general is unpredictable, belligerent, chaotic. That inherently creates a large degree of economic uncertainty, which markets and industry sectors hate. It's hard to argue. Well,
but they don't seem to, though.
What's
because
that?
Every time the market goes down, it comes back. I mean,
but that's the uncertainty element. I can't tell you today that's going to be net down. But the zigzag nature of it, I don't think anyone really enjoys. And if you're a business owner, if you're a trader, or whatever, you got to project a couple years out. This up and down nature does not feel good. And you already have, so you have Rust Belt senators like Sherrod Brown, like Bob Casey, like Joe Manchin. They're being supportive of Trump, but red state, farm state Democrats are not. Claire McCaskill, they got pork in Missouri, they got soybeans in Missouri. Industries that China's retaliating against now. She is steadfast against what Trump is doing. John Tester was on a North Dakota radio show hosted by Jeff Heitkamp, who's Heidi Heitkamp's brother. And then North Carolina, also another farm state. Montana is a farm state. Jeff Heitkamp says to Tester, we're getting punched in the nose by these tariffs. And then Tester's a farmer himself. He goes on a whole long thing about every time this or anything happens, the ag products get retaliated against first, and this is not a good path that we're down. And so these are, Tester and Heitkamp's sister and McCaskill, these are all folks who also have tough re-elections in red states.
Right.
But they're listening to their constituents who are saying, I have farmers who want to export goods to China, and now their export costs are going up. Even if they stand down, no one's going to feel great about being put through the ringer like this. To what end? What are you going to get out of it at the end of the day? I mean, it's possible we don't have a calamity by 2020 that sparks massive inflation or a big recession. I can't predict that. But to go through a lot of agita for status quo doesn't feel great either.
Trump does put us all through a lot. I mean, even if nothing ever comes out of it, just the toll that it takes.
So if you're a Democrat, you got to decide, you know, the conventional wisdom of 2016, which sorely bared out, was, you know, TPP was bad politically. People were sick and tired of multinational trade deals that don't benefit workers. And Obama was over his skis, and Hillary had to scurry back to the populist position. And since she was seen as milquetoast Donna, people went with Trump, who was seen as more authentic on that subject. But in 2016, you're at the tail end of a long list of presidents who, generally speaking, campaigned like trade populists,
right?
Campaigned like China skeptics, and then governed more like free traders.
So where's Josh Hawley and, you know, Claire McCaskill's opponent?
Right.
And Kevin Cramer.
In North Dakota.
North Dakota. Where? How are they balancing?
You know, I don't know off the top of my head.
I'd be curious. I don't either.
I'm curious. But the point I want to make here is, so you have this long line of presidents who just sort of campaign one way and govern another. I mean, it's a little oversimplified, but I think that's sort of the general perception. And people were kind of fed up with it, feel like, what have we gotten out of this regime? But 2020 is a totally different kind of president pursuing a totally different kind of trade policy. However it turns out exactly, it's not going to be any kind of you know, addition to the current international trade regime. It's going to be an attempt to weaken it or turn back from it. And even if you can't predict how bad that's going to be, it's not going to be great. It's not going to have magically turned around our manufacturing sector and create a whole bunch of jobs. So, and it's really going to upset a lot of farm state people. So, Democrats have to make a decision. How are we going to be? I mean, in 2018, you could say, let the manufacturing state folks go over here, let the farm state folks go over here. You can pull that up. By 2020, you're going to have to take a side.
But, like, isn't the best case scenario here just that people like in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin love Donald Trump hardcore? Isn't that like the best case scenario? Like, that's a political win for him in the Rust Belt sort of area?
Well, certainly, I think in those areas, they are far more supportive of these tariff policies. Now, so two things I'd say about that. One, it didn't save Rick Saccone in Western Pennsylvania. They supported the tariffs, but you had a guy on the ground saying, well, I support him too, and didn't get you very far. I would expect all the Congress people in those areas to take that stance. Now, I'm less certain if the love for the policy is going to be there in 2020. Today, it's thank God somebody's fighting for us. But in 2 years, if the jobs don't actually come back, do they feel the same way? I can't say that for sure right now.
They have to find somebody who's stopping it from really working, right? Somebody to blame.
Well, everyone wants a scapegoat, and the obvious scapegoat in 2020 is Donald Trump. You had 4 years to do this. This was one of your number one issues. You got to do things your way, and what do we have to show for it?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point, right? So, like, how does a populist insurgent stay a populist insurgent when they're the man?
Well,
I mean, obviously it happens. Authoritarians do it all the time. They blame America a lot of times. How do we do it?
You do it by continually moving the goalposts. So let's take immigration. Trump gets in as president in 2017. Immediately he says, wow, border crossings, wow, they're plummeting. I just showed up here. And with my tough talk, they knew I meant business and they stopped crossing the border. Problem solved. And now it's he's getting himself tied up in knots, saying now we have this surge going over the border again. It's because of our pathetic, weak laws that are all Obama's fault, and Congress isn't doing anything about it. Now, anyone who's taken 2 seconds to look to square those comments, you know that he completely overstated his success back in February 2017. He completely ignored there's a cyclical nature of immigration flow, and taking credit for something that happened in 1 month does not say anything about your actual policies. But I don't think his loyal supporters want to square those two data points. They're going to take Trump's side every step of the way because he's continually deflecting the focus against some other enemy and away from himself. So clearly you can get away with that with your base for some period of time. I don't know how long the shelf life is in that kind of strategy.
Indeed. All right. Where do you want to go? What do you want to talk about?
We had things we wanted to talk about, didn't we?
Well, we could talk about movies.
Oh, right. You interviewed the producer for Chappaquiddick.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, before I talk about that, I do want to also give a plug for another movie I saw called The Death of Stalin.
Oh, I really want to see that.
Which is... have you seen the preview of the trailer?
I saw the preview. I mean, understand, I never go to the movies anymore because I don't want to pay for a babysitter to go to the movies. And most movies are terrible. But I love Veep, and I haven't seen his other stuff. I want to see In the Loop, and I want to see this.
Well, it's really hard to make a comedy about about mass murderers. But they did it. And some great actors.
Though I assume they don't show the mass graves, I assume.
No, but I mean there are allusions to they don't I mean you they don't they don't make it all out to be just fun and games. I mean part of the humorous part is I'll give you an example. I don't think I'm going to spoil too much, but so for example, like Stalin dies, and they're pretty sure he's dead, but they're not 100% sure. They need to bring in a doctor, but Stalin has killed all the best doctors in Moscow. So they have to bring in like a team of like B-rate, you know, the second class doctors to like see if they can revive him. And you know, the joke is like, if they do revive him, that's proof they were good doctors. And if they can't, it doesn't matter because he's dead. He won't be mad at us. But it does show, I think I think there's a, it satirically mocks and shows you, that's an example of showing you like the problems with the way that the Soviet Union was run. So I would recommend it. But the movie that I also want to recommend and did interview the producer of is Chappaquiddick, which is out in theaters Friday.
And then you've seen it?
I've seen it twice.
How did you get the preview?
Screeners. Actually, in both instances, Bill, because I'm a powerful political not only political commentator, but apparently also movie reviewer. I have people send me books and screeners.
Very nice.
And it's
very
really
nice.
Cool. Sometimes now, because I don't really have a DVD player. Like, I have this external DVD drive, but they will send you a website with a code you can put in. So, you know, who needs to leave the house, my friend?
Now, Chappaquiddick was the Benghazi of the baby boomer conservatives. Obsessed for decades, constantly dogged Ted Kennedy with it, arguably successfully prevented him from becoming president, because that was always a cloud over his head, but didn't derail his entire political career. The left always defended Kennedy through that and still treated him as the liberal lion and, you know, died with a hail of accolades. Let me ask you, what was your opinion about Chappaquiddick before the movie? And did the movie and the interview with the producer alter your thinking about it at all?
Well, first let me say, because you brought up Benghazi, I think it's worth pointing out that there's a ton of conservative movies out there that suck, and they're done with a political agenda in mind, and this is not one of those. Like, this is legitimately a good movie.
Is this a conservative movie?
It really isn't. It's a movie, it's a conservative movie in the way that The Doors is a liberal movie, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's a conservative movie. That's a bad example, but like in the way that All the President's Men is a liberal movie, okay. Right? So it's a good piece of art. It's totally legit, factually, or at least within the realm of artistic license.
I've read about certain quibbles.
Okay, it's not propaganda, but so first I would say part of what makes it a good movie, it's got Bruce Dern, Ed Helms, Kate Mara, Jim Gaffigan, the comedian. So there's a comedic element to it, which I think was needed because it just like the death of Stalin, mm-hmm. it helps to have some comic relief, mm-hmm. even a little bit. I think that I feel even a little bit less favorable toward Ted Kennedy now than before. I will say one of the interesting things that, occurred to me, there were a few things that occurred to me when watching the movie. One of them is that there were no guardrails on this bridge. And they were actually digitally removed in the movie because they now there are now guardrails on the bridge, thanks to Ted Kennedy. But there weren't any guardrails, and if there were, then Ted Kennedy might have been president and Mary Jo Kopechne might still be alive. But instead of guardrails, there was like this little, like, like ledge that was like maybe a foot tall. And so what happened is when you hit that bridge at an angle going fast, that actually caused the car to go, to tip over upside down. And this is the other thing that I talked to the producer, whose name's, I'm going to make sure I pronounce it right, Mark Chardy. It's spelled C-I-A-R, but I think it's Chardy. And by the way, the producers produced a whole bunch of other movies, usually sports movies for like Disney. So like Miracle, the Mark Wahlberg movie, movies like that. I'm trying to think. And the Miracle wasn't, Miracle was Kurt Russell. Invincible was Mark Wahlberg. So that sort of genre. And he's a former baseball player. In fact, his only win in the big leagues was against the Baltimore Orioles. But he had a, you know, he's a good athlete to make it to the bigs. Anyway, the other thing that occurred to me, I didn't realize this, but there's an argument that Mary Jo Kopechne might have lived like an hour in that car. She there was like an air pocket, but it's completely pitch black dark. You don't know what's up and what's down, so your sense of direction is off. You can't tell, maybe even, I guess with the air pocket, you know which way is up, but once it's submerged, you wouldn't. It's completely dark. He said they had to light it for the movie purposes, but in reality, it would have been pitch black. And of course, you think you could open a door underwater, but good luck.
Right.
Maybe if you're lucky, you could wind a window down. Anyway, that was the, so I would say like the fact that like, why no guardrails? Like we should, this is a good case for regulation. Bridges, especially if they're in deep bodies of water, not just like a foot of water, probably should have guardrails on them. And I think also what also hit me was, and Mark Chardy interviewed, he interviewed the diver, the scuba diver who went down the next day. Ted Kennedy, of course, doesn't report this for like 8 or 9 hours. He's having lunch. Another interesting thing is Ed Helms' character, which I knew nothing about, is based off of Kennedy's cousin, who was essentially their adopted brother. His name is Joe Gargan. He just died in December. And Joe Gargan was actually kind of, if there is a hero in the story, sort of the hero of the story. He was the voice of reason, and he was the one basically telling Teddy, you've got to report this immediately, not only because it's the right thing to do, but for your political future as your lawyer, you need to report this immediately. So a lot of cool stuff. I did the podcast. It's on Matt Lewis in the News. We talked about all this. I don't think that any of this spoils the movie in any way. In fact, I think it actually might be a better watch after knowing some of these things. Because everybody sort of knows, and we know how the story is, right? But the acting is very good. Like, they didn't go too far with the crazy, like, Mayor Quimby accent, you know, the Boston accent, but it's not overdone.
Right.
It's a well done movie, and I think they also, in fairness to Ted Kennedy, I'll tell you something else I didn't realize. I didn't know that this happened like at the exact same time as man landed on the moon, as the moon landed. I just for whatever reason didn't realize that, and that sort of serves a couple of purposes, as you can imagine artistically. But one of them is sort of showing how Teddy is always in the shadow of his three brothers, actually, and his father, and the pressure on him, which is maybe the only, because his excuses for not reporting it all seem bogus. You know, he claimed that he had a concussion, which seems bogus. He wore this neck brace to Mary Jo Kopechne's funeral, which seems lame. He claimed that he was on sedatives, or that he was in such a bad shape that the doctor put him on sedatives, but he couldn't have been on sedatives if he had a concussion. It was like a lot of weird things like that. But the one thing that I think might make you a little sympathetic for Ted's plight is the weird pressure that he was under to be the only living Kennedy and living in the shadows specifically at this moment during the moon landing. So I learned some stuff from watching it.
All right. Well, check out the podcast. Yeah. I have a new podcast up for my New Books in Politics podcast. Talk to Carl Cannon from Real Clear Politics.
Two of my favorite people.
Talk about his book, On the State.
Carl was my editor at Politics Daily and a mentor. And a great guy.
No, he's a fantastic guy to interview, so do check that out. And my next one's going to be Salon's Amanda Marcotte, whose book Troll Nation is coming out later this month.
Bill, let me just say, she is one of those people, when I see something she tweeted, that I just want to pull my hair out.
that's the person you want to interview, isn't it?
No. Because when I talk to somebody like you, who's a liberal, I feel like, oh, he's misguided, clearly, but he's a decent, good person. We could work out a deal. We want the best for America, but we see things a little differently. With her, completely opposite worldview, and I've actually had to mute her on Twitter. I wasn't even following her, but I had to mute her so that she wouldn't just be retweeted into my timeline.
I think you should reserve your judgment and have a chance to hear a long-form discussion.
Oh, I will.
And see what transpires.
I will take a couple of Xanax, and I will listen to your podcast.
So, and what else you had to plug?
The podcast, we mentioned my Daily Beast column, this week, what I've written, but the podcast, we're doing some cool stuff, aside from, let me think of who I'm having on. Aside from Chappaquiddick, I'm having on Tim Alberta.
Oh, he's
from
fantastic.
Politico Magazine, who is, and email me if you have anything you think I should ask him. I mean, he has become maybe maybe the most important like feature writer / political profile writer of our time.
And he generally profiles conservative figures.
Yeah, yeah. And so like he did one on Dave Ramsey. Mm-hmm. Do you know who that is, Bill?
He's a radio guy, right?
Yeah. But he's huge in the sort of in the South and in the evangelical world. Like the church that I go to actually had a whole series where we watched his video, and I think he sells it to churches, and it's about financial well-being, like how to get out of debt. And but like most people indeed, like Tim, in preparation for interviewing Tim, I've been listening to other interviews, and I heard him say that like when he pitched this idea at Politico, nobody else had ever heard of Dave Ramsey. But he's done a great one with Tim Scott.
Mm-hmm. His Pat Buchanan one is superb.
Pat Buchanan, John Boehner.
Yeah, oh, the Boehner one. So, that was also exceptional. Really, Tim Alberta is that's going to be a good talk. There's no way it's not going to be a good talk.
So let me know if you have any thoughts on what I should ask him. Like sort of what direction I should go, let me know.
Absolutely. All
but
right.
That's the kind of stuff we deliver at Matt Lewis and the News. I got something else to plug. Mm-hmm. Matt Lewis and the Newsletter.
Wow, newsletter.
Matt Lewis and the Newsletter.
Oh, nice.
If you go to mattklewis.com and you sign up from my email list in the upper right-hand corner, you will now get a weekly newsletter from me. And I'll tell you what it is. So it'll be like – it'll keep you up to date with like my columns and my podcasts. And there'll be – but on top of that, what am I watching, right? So like for example, the latest Matt Lewis in the Newsletter has a piece about I think there's a piece about the Death of Stalin movie, right?
Yeah.
Which isn't my podcast, but a movie I saw. The one last week had a great podcast I heard. It's called The Edge of Fame. And they did one with, remember the rock band or the pop band Hanson? The boy band Hanson?
Yes.
So they're still, and the podcast is called How Hanson Beat the System. And they still live in Tulsa. They're happily, you know, they're all three married to different women. They didn't flame out. They didn't get drug addicted.
Right.
And so I'm featuring some of the podcasts of other people's shows that I'm listening to and liking. So go to mattklewis.com, sign up for Matt Lewis and the newsletter in the upper right-hand corner. That's my new thing.
All right. Exciting. All right. Well, till next week.
See you guys.
Bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.